This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For more than 40 years, Grammy Award winner David Holt has worked to preserve the musical traditions of Appalachia. Fans of traditional music will be familiar with him because of his performances with greats like Grandpa Jones, Bill Monroe, Earl Scruggs, Chet Atkins, and of course Doc Watson. He has hosted TV shows on cable and public broadcasting. He's had a public radio show. And while most of his work has focused in the mountains, his story didn't begin there. It begins on the ranch lands of Gatesville, Texas, where his people moved from North Carolina in 1885. David Holt joins us now to share his adventures, play some music, and talk about The State of Music, a new one-hour public television special that examines the modern masters of traditional music in western North Carolina. David Holt, welcome to The State of Things.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great to be here, Frank.
Well, as I said, you are in Asheville now, and much of your work is focused on the mountains, but your story didn't begin there. It begins in Gatesville, Texas. Tell us about growing up.
Well, I was born in Gatesville, and I basically had my entire family there in Texas. And so in 1957, Sputnik went up in the air. My dad was an inventor, and he thought he ought to move to California where there was the electronic industry busting loose. And so when I was in about sixth grade, we moved to California. But I kept going back to Texas all the summers, and that's sort of our spiritual home, I guess, for the Holt family.
Well, and I'm told that your mother had to teach you a lesson about hard work in some of those hot fields in Texas. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we were coming back from the grocery store one day. I was probably seven or something, and we're in the car, and we'd just been to the grocery store, and we were really mad at my mom because she refused to buy us the jar of Ovaltine that had the coupon for the Captain Midnight decoder ring in it. And, man, she really got mad, and she said, "You boys, you think money grows on trees. You're just so spoiled." And she pulled the car over and said, "Get out of the car." And we were standing on the edge of like 1,000 acres of cotton, which, they grew around Gatesville. And she grabbed us by the ears, and she marched us up to the foreman. She said, "I got these two little boys here who never worked a day in their lives." And we're both just like, 7 and 8 years old. And "Put them to work," she said. And so the foreman gave us each a big cotton sack. They're about 10 feet long. And showed us how to get the cotton out of the center. And we tried to do that. But if you've ever picked cotton in Texas in August, it's hot. And by that time, all the cotton plants are real stickery. And our hands were starting to bleed. And, we started to cry. And we looked up. And my mom standing up by the car. And she just looked like this. She wasn't about to give in. But the foreman saw he was in over his head, and so he kind of snuck up behind my brother and me, and he just started singing out in a low voice. He started singing, "There's a long white robe in heaven, I know. I don't want it to leave me behind." And all these beautiful black voices came just chiming in with him. And so for the rest of the afternoon, they all sang as we picked cotton. We stopped crying. We stopped messing around, and we just picked cotton the whole rest of the day. Because it was such, I'd never seen anything like it and heard anything like it. And so that was my opening to, one of the openings to traditional music for me. It was just like I was in the very heart of it. And that's where I've, tried to be ever since.
That's interesting. I mean, I could guess that you didn't have a kind of a spiritual awakening about the power of music in that moment, though you may have. But if not, when did you come back to that story? When did you sort of, as you moved forward in your life, documenting traditional music, did you look back on that moment as something pretty special?
Well, when you're interviewed a lot, you try to think, well, how did I get here? How did this come about? Because it is a pretty unusual story. And that was just one of the things, that was one of the musical experiences I had, that just to be in the middle of 100 black people picking cotton, singing together, very, very powerful for a little white boy, And then the other thing I think that really stirred my interest were the bones. My dad and granddad, they both played the bones. And I'm talking about real rib bones, cow rib bones, or they can be made out of wood, about 7 inches long. And you get a rhythm sound with them. Can I just show you what that sounds like?
Yeah.
So this is something that had been handed down through our family from my great-great-grandfather, who was the fellow that came from Texas in the 1800s that you were talking about.
Okay, well, now, came to Texas? Did he come from North Carolina?
Yeah, he came from Alamance County, North Carolina, where there are many, many Holts. And he moved to Midland, Texas, actually, taking the bones with him. And he played them all through the Civil War. Anyway, they sound like this. Let me show you. So you shake them. But where they really come alive is when you have a little music with them. Like, I've got a harmonica here, and let me just show you what that sounds like. So these guys were not musicians, but this was just something that was a family heritage thing. And I still have those bones from my great-great-grandfather that he had made in the Civil War.
How old were you when you first saw that demonstration and heard that music?
Oh, you know, I guess from the time I was born. Yeah. But my dad and granddad sort of showed me how to do it at about 10. I mean, that's when you're kind of coordinated enough to do something
to do that. Your family moved from Texas when you were in junior high. Then you moved to California. You talked about that being where the future was. What was that move like for you?
Oh, it was really rough. All I knew was Texas, and it really hadn't even been out of the state. And, you know, I had an old Texas grandmother who was just, you know, a raw bone Texas lady, and, you know, she had all 32 teeth pulled in one sitting with no anesthetic. That's what kind of gal she was. And she said, don't ever ask anybody if they're from Texas. If they are, they'll tell you. If they're not, why embarrass them? So, you know, so when I moved to California with that sort of frame of mind, but I fell in love with California. I learned to surf and got in a band. The band that when you opened the show, you played the Persuaders with my friend Chris Gordon and Byron Case. And we did that record. That record went to number 13, by the way.
Number 13 on the Billboard Top 40 in 1961, right?
That's right. And then the very Top next 100. Week, the very next week, the Beatles came out with I Want to Hold Your Hand. And that was like, you know, instantly out of date, that surf music.
I want to get a little bit more of a feel for that song called Ski Storm by the Persuaders.
Yeah.
That's a little bit of a song called Ski Storm by the Persuaders, 1961. The drummer, 16-year-old David Holt, my guest today on The State of Things. David, I understand that you had a quick name change after that song charted, didn't you?
Yes. The producer was Kim Fowley, and people who know about you know, the L.A. music scene in those days will know that, you know, he produced many songs, but Alley Oop was one of his big hits. And he would just get bands together and say, why don't you make up a song about – to us, he said, why don't you make a song about skiing? There's plenty of surf songs, and we'll just have it be called Ski Storm. And so we sat down, about six of us, and part of the band, the Sun Rays, and our little band, and wrote that song in an afternoon, recorded it the next day. It was out within a week.
Whatever happened to the band?
Oh, they're all still good buddies of mine. Yeah. And the Sun Rays went on to be actually quite a well-known band in Southern California, sort of a Beach Boys type band.
So you were not going to be second to the Beatles. You moved on. Is that the idea?
We were wiped off the face of the map by the Beatles. But I love their music. That was a real eye-opener.
Well, after high school, you moved to San Francisco. You went to San Francisco State, but then you dropped out. What happened?
Well, I was in the, you know, the early hippie days. It was just a great time to be there, 1966 and 67, and it was just a small little community. I mean, to give you an example, like Janis Joplin lived down the block from me. She wasn't famous at all. I saw her in a room with about five people she was performing for. Jimi Hendrix lived down there, too, in the Hill Street area. Anyway, so I guess that was just I sort of stopped playing music at that time because I was going to college, and then about 2 years into college, I thought, what am I going to do? You know, maybe I would like to teach. Seems like teaching is something I could do. And so I got a job at a private elementary school in Martinez, California, and that changed my life.
Well, you had a traumatic experience at that school. Tell us about that.
The very first night I was there, they put my girlfriend and I up at the school because they didn't have a place for us to live yet. And we were, She was inside. I was standing out in the parking lot looking up at the stars. And, you know, I do remember the thought. I was 21 years old, and I was thinking, you know, that light coming from those stars is 50 million years old. This is the thought I was having when a car just pulled up. Three guys jumped out of the car and started running right at me. Now, I was new here. I knew they didn't know me. There was no reason for anybody to be running at me. And I turned around and started to run when I realized they were yelling stuff. But they caught up with me, and, you know, I remember two fists hitting me in the jaw at the same time and just feeling my face just crack and just give way and my jaw break and, you know, blood everywhere and fell on the ground. And then they kicked me a few times. And then they went into the school, and they luckily they didn't find Linda. She was hiding in there. But they tore up the school and broke out the windows and smashed the TV and stuff like that, and then came back out and saw me on the ground just still, you know, passed out, actually. And they said, I remember them saying, I think this guy's dead. Let's get out of here. So,
well, I'm talking to Grammy Award winner David Holt. We're going to take a break right there, talk about how that affected you and your career, a career that landed you a Grammy and one of the true experts and lovers of Appalachian folk music. Got a PBS special coming up. We'll talk to David Holt more about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, meeting musician-entertainer David Holt. David's going to host a one-hour special on UNC-TV January 29th at 10 o'clock called David Holt's State of Music. We're going to talk more about that soon. But, David, just before the break, you told us about being beaten and left for dead in your first teaching job in Northern California. After that, you moved to Santa Barbara, right?
That's right, yeah. I ended up teaching up there, though, with my jaw wired shut for, like, weeks, you know. It was rough.
Did you ever find out what that was all about? What was
no.
behind? No. Wow.
No, they never caught the guys. And I think it was just, you know, the school was a Summerhillian-type school, not radical, but just, you know, alternative, out in the country. And I think these were just, you know, local rowdy guys.
So what did you do next? You did move to Santa Barbara eventually.
I did move to Santa Barbara because I wanted to I needed to heal some way, and I got a job as a rose wrangler for a lady. This gal had 200 different types of roses in her big backyard in Santa Barbara Mountains, and my job was to tend the roses, and that was incredibly healing because at night I would sit out there and those roses would open up, and about 5 o'clock they would start all letting out their scents, and oh man, it was just a great thing. And at that time I started listening to cowboy music. There was, one of the teachers at the school after I got beat up, had a collection of old 78s, and he had some old cowboy songs. I thought, that's what I feel like. I feel like a lone cowboy out here just barely surviving. And so that got me interested in cowboy music, and I listened to as much of that as I could when I lived in Santa Barbara.
Eventually, you moved to the Southern Mountains, to this part of the country. What inspired your trip out this way?
Well, I went to see Carl Sprague, the very first cowboy singer ever to record. I heard that he was alive in Texas. He recorded in 1927 songs like Bury Me Not on the Lone Prairie and the Old Chisholm Trail and Utah Carol and things like this. And, you know, he taught me how to play the harmonica like I was playing a minute ago, like that kind of stuff. And I thought, this is so great. You can go see your mentors if they're not too famous. You know, people have kind of forgotten about him. But to me, I thought this is the greatest thing in the world. And so I wanted to do more of that. I wasn't a folklorist. And I met Ralph Stanley at a concert when he came out to play at UC Santa Barbara, where I was going to school. He said, well, if you want to learn more of that or learn the clawhammer banjo style, is what I was asking him for. He said, you need to go back to the Southern Mountains. He said, there's lots of old people still play in that old style now. And so that was 69, and my friend Steve Keith and I left and came to North Carolina, spent the whole summer traveling around, visiting musicians, going to fiddler's conventions.
So it was really an inspiration initially. I mean, you wanted to learn how to play and realized that you had access. So the kind of the anthropological folklorist part of it actually was kind of secondary. That was happening to you as you were learning to play this kind of music.
You know, I wanted to be involved. I wanted to get in the middle of it. I didn't want to sort of look at the side actually in those days there weren't DVDs and books you could learn from very much, but I wanted to just be right in the heart of it. And and when I came back to the Southern Mountains, I realized that, there were hundreds, literally hundreds of fine musicians born back in the late 1800s at this point, because we're talking 1969. And so they were in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And, like finding the lost world.
You did learn the clawhammer style from a man named Fred Cochran, right?
He's one of them. Yeah, he was one of my main guys. Yeah, Fred Cochran and Tommy Jarrell down in Mount Airy, North Carolina.
And what did they do? I mean, this guy from Texas, maybe California, maybe he's not from around here, shows up and says, "Hey, I really want," and he's young guy, "teach me this music." They take you right in. Were they suspicious? How'd that go at first?
Well, now nobody actually teaches. Most of these traditional players don't know what they're doing and how they're doing it. They haven't broken it down like a teacher would. But if you watch really closely and go back and try to remember how they did it, take a tape recorder if you got one, and then come back and do it again, you know what I found is that older folks are so happy to have a young person learning. They are so glad to teach you. And I was completely transparent about it. I wasn't. All I wanted to do was learn it, and they could understand that, you know. And in those days, in the 60s, many of the mountain people were kind of turning away from the older traditional music. And so they were pleased to see a young guy who was interested and happy for you to watch or teach you or whatever they could.
You picked it up pretty well. I wonder if you could demonstrate the clawhammer style for us.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. It's still one of my favorite things in the world. So we're mostly used to hearing three-finger banjo playing, which has that syncopated kind of rolling sound. Well, clawhammer has a loping kind of. And it's the oldest style, the style that came from Africa with the banjo a couple hundred years ago. Let me play just a little bit of, say, something like Cotton Eye Joe or.
David Holt is my guest on The State of Things Now. He's got a special coming up on public television at the end of the month. It's going to look at the traditions of this kind of music, particularly in Western North Carolina. So this is the kind of music, as you say, was almost fading out in the mountains itself. People were moving toward more modern kinds of music. What were you expecting? Was this just for your own edification? Did you think you could actually make a living learning this kind of thing?
I had no intention of making a living. That was not the least bit, in my plan. In fact, when I came to Asheville, I didn't even want to teach. I got a job as a sign maker because I had degrees in biology and art, and so I was using that. And there's still signs around Asheville that I made back in the 1970s. My intention was just to learn, really just to learn, and I just was so eager and spent so much time at it and dedicated to really trying to learn it well that, I started learning it. And I'm still learning it. I never stop. Same energy as now.
We just got an email from a listener who wants to know if you remember hanging out in the Thompson-Conway household, and I'm going to leave that to you, the Thompson-Conway household when the Red Clay Ramblers were getting started in the 1970s. Were you any
absolutely.
Part of that group? Yeah.
Oh yeah. Tommy Thompson was one of the other young people. Now Tommy was probably, I don't know, 15 years older than me, I would guess, but he had been a young guy who had gone around and learned from old folks too. There weren't that many in those days. In fact, it was so unusual that somebody came to Asheville to learn music from the old people that I got a big old article in the paper, a full page in the paper, and that really kind of started my career off of performing. People started asking me to come play, and I said, well, I'll try it. And I realized I really loved entertaining and I really loved performing.
And
it gave you a reason to put all the music together.
Put it all together. When did you start thinking about sort of cataloging this, making and communicating the importance of this and even some of the traditions and the instruments to an audience that may not be as familiar?
From the very beginning. I mean, when I did my very first concert here at the Asheville Public Library that John Bridges put on for me, I realized that's what I wanted to do, and I wanted to learn how to do it really well. I wanted to learn how to take an older music that not that many people cared about or knew about and present it to a modern audience. And, of course, Doc Watson was a very big influence on me, even through his records at that time, because basically that's what Doc did. He took older songs and made them sound new and took new songs and made them sound old. So he was always high on my list of mentors.
And the instruments as well. I mean, we're all familiar with Doc. He played some fairly conventional instruments, you know, particularly the guitar. But when you think about the some of the instruments that you've had that have been around for a while, that we might have lost track of. The mouth bow is a pretty good example of that.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. I mean, there was an old man up in Sodom, North Carolina. It's a little community up in Madison County. And he played two things. He played the mouth bow, and he played the paper bag. Now, he was an old, I mean, he was an uber geezer if there was one. And so he would take this is just a stick now with a string on it, and you play it by putting it up to your mouth and picking the note, and then you move your mouth to be bigger or smaller to make the note vary just a little bit. You know, you only have one note. So can I play you just a little piece of it? You see what it sounds like? Well, have you heard the many stories told by young and old with joy about the many deeds of daring that were done by the Johnson boys? You take Kate and I'll take Sal, and we'll both have a Johnson gal. You take Kate and I'll take Sal, and we'll both have a Johnson gal.
You know, if the Tuva singers of Central Asia knew about the mouth bow, it could have saved them a lot of practice trying to.
Oh, they knew about it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an instrument that's in every culture in the world.
Yeah, it's a great sound. But is it part of the music today? You talked about Doc Watson, about people who have been able to reproduce and then move forward these traditional sounds. Does it make its way into music today? That sound, that aesthetic.
Well, I just gave Brian Sutton one, a mouth bow, and he used it on a recording with Dierks Bentley, so maybe we're going to hear
some more of that.
Know.
Well, you helped found the Appalachian Music Program at Warren Wilson College.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. What was that? What was that all about, and what were your intentions with that?
Well, that was a wonderful thing for me. I hadn't really been in town that long, but I had been so eager to find out all the different groups, the bluegrass people, the ballad singers, the old-time people. And a lot of them didn't maybe get along together. And so they hired me at Warren Wilson to start this Appalachian music program and get people from the tradition on campus to teach how to do ballad singing and fiddling, guitar playing, everything you can think of. And so we got grants and started the Appalachian music program. And it was the first program of its kind to have applied music in the traditional arts, you know, the traditional music. And now it's developed into the Swannanoa Gathering that happens in the summer, and it's a wonderful thing. It was a wonderful thing for me. I was like two steps ahead of my students in studying, but it was just absolutely great and produced a lot of really good players.
All of this, a lot of serious effort into making this music, this folk tradition and heritage available to all of us, and you were on Hee Haw.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, that was fun.
Yeah, tell us about that experience. What'd you do?
So I was on the Grand Ole Opry in 1980, and the very first time I was on there, I actually played the paper bag because I thought, okay, I got to do something really different. And so the producers of Hee Haw saw me on there, heard me on there, and they hired me to, you know, come be a featured guest on Hee Haw, and I did that a number of times until they finally just started having me almost every show, where I would open up the second half of the show with some kind of old-timey song that the Roy Acuff and Roy Clark and Grandpa and all the whole cast could come out and sing on the set of this old, it'd be like an old Victorian house. And it was just a great, wonderful thing because we would tape for a week straight. And if you didn't have to, if your part wasn't being taped that day, then you had time to just hang around with all these guys. And, you know, these were some of my big heroes, especially Acuff and Grandpa Jones.
That's pretty cool. But now, I understand that you had a little run-in with makeup. They wanted to give you a wig at one point, am I right?
Yeah, the very first – I mean, if you remember Hee-Haw, it was like people were, you know, made up by undertakers. It looked like very, very thick makeup. And so I was sitting in the chair on my very first time on there, and they took an eyebrow pencil and started – drawing in my hair. Now, I just had a receding hairline at that time. You know, I had hair. And so they were just drawing. I said, wait a minute. What are you doing? And she said, well, I'm going to either have to do this every time you're on, or you're going to have to get a toupee, or you're going to have to wear a hat. I said, well, I love wearing a hat. I've got a hat in the car. I'm going to get a hat, you know. And I just found that almost became like a logo because people could remember your face and a hat much easier than they could just remember either a face or a hat.
So, how do people, you know, you talked about that because I sadly do remember that show. I mean, the part of it, of course, that we remember not so fondly is the kind of the way it stereotyped the South and some of the humor. But you're talking about some very serious music and real serious serious performers who were actually on that show. How were they taking? How did they see guys like Roy Acuff? How did they see their role on a show like that? That does get to the mainstream, that brings this stuff to a little larger audience, but with it, this other vision of the South and the mountains.
I don't think they had any particular problem with it. I did, though, and I told them I wouldn't do the cornfield or any of those kind of cornball things, and would often wear a suit and things like that on the show just for that very reason you're talking about. But you know, it had so many people that loved that show, and here's a really interesting thing. I would be recognized in airports and stuff by more black people than I would by white folks because they loved to watch Hee Haw, and I thought that was really cool. I said, yeah, we grew up with country music. You know, we just like well-played music. And so I was pleased with that aspect of it.
Well, tell us about you. You auditioned to perform at the Grand Ole Opry, and there's a story behind that audition as well. Tell us that.
Yeah. Well, so I took my class from – I was still teaching and still directing the Appalachian Music Program. I had a history of country music class. I took them down to see the Opry. We're sitting in the audience, and I said, man, this is boring. They need – some old-time music on here. I mean, it was Uncle Dave Macon and people like that, String Bean, that started the Grand Ole Opry. I said, they really need some of that stuff. And so I went home and I called the manager of the Opry, and he said, well, I don't know anybody that plays old-time music, any young people anyway. And I said, well, I do. I could come play it for you. He said, well, come on down. And so my friend Ann Romaine, who lived in Nashville, she said, listen, if you go down there, don't you just wear like your Levi's and a T-shirt or something. You know, you dress up like you're going to dress, even though you're going to just be in his office. So I bought a white suit and a white hat, you know, thinking about Mark Twain. And I had a beautiful banjo that I play that I had made. And I went down and played for him with all my instruments. And he said at the end of the thing, he said, okay, we'll put you on in a couple of weeks. And that's how I started playing on the Opry.
And had to wear that white suit. That's the deal. That's kind of an interesting thought, though, to think about this music and how important it is. I mean, you talked about the first time it meant something to you was when you're recovering from, you know, a near-death experience, a bad beating, and you hear a cowboy song that a lot of us, you know, being alone on the old prairie, doesn't have much connection with us until you're down there. And this music is powerful, not because we were born in the mountains necessarily, because you might not have been, but it somehow connects with us. There's that aspect of this music that's kind of universal. And then there's this sort of the commodification and the logoification, you know, the sort of identification with, you know, sequins and whatever else Grand Ole Opry brings to it. Yeah. Have you thought about that kind of how we sort of in popular culture, you know, create stereotypes, and yet the music transcends all of that?
Yeah, because there's people who will really get it. And this type of music does not need to be a national fad. In fact, when it was a national fad in the 60s, you know, it got pretty diluted and I think pretty messed up. But, you know, it just needs enough people to keep it going. And I think people hear the soulful. I mean, let me just give you an example. I got a banjo that's made in 1860s with catgut strings and a groundhog hide head. And I mean, you know, doesn't this, I don't care who you are, doesn't... My name is George Buck, never had no luck, I've always been treated this way, boys, always been treated this way. I said, oh me, oh Lord am I, always been treated this way.
Musician, entertainer, communicator, David Holt, today on The State of Things. Tell you what, I want to take a break right now. We're going to continue this conversation, though, and talk about your 14 years performing with Doc Watson on The State of Things. Stay with us.
I can see all them pretty girls looking at me down the road, down the road. I got to see the way down the road.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Grammy Award winner David Holt, a musician, a storyteller, hosted many TV shows, and he's got a special coming up on UNC TV January 29th that features the music mostly in Western North Carolina. So, you know, you talked about Doc Watson earlier, and you got to know him pretty well, didn't you?
Doc was like a musical father to me, yeah. I knew him since 1972, but we really started playing together on all of his concerts in 1998, till he passed away. So, yeah, he was my good buddy.
How did that partnership begin?
Let's see. He was on Fire on the Mountain. I had a television show for the Nashville Network called Fire on the Mountain that I hosted. And Doc was one of our first guests, Doc and Merle. And, man, at the end of the show, we would play together. I'd play with the guests. And there was something about the rhythm that just clicked in that all three of us really felt and wanted to do more of that. So in 1985, I asked them if they would play on a recording with me called Reel and Rock. And that's the name of an old mountain song. And so it was just – it's just – sort of a magical record, and I think that really got us going. And then Merle was killed in a traffic accident. I mean, a tractor accident. Thank you. And then my daughter was killed in a traffic accident about 3 years later. And somehow those deaths of children really cemented us, because Doc was one of the first people that came down to the house when Sarah Jane was killed, and he didn't hardly say anything. He just sat in the corner with his guitar, just playing very quiet, beautiful music, and it was incredibly helpful. And so there was that connection, and then the musical connection. And the way it really got started, though, to answer your question, was in 1998, UNC-TV asked us to do a concert together. And it's called An Evening with Doc Watson and David Holt. And Doc really didn't want to practice. He didn't care to rehearse. He didn't want to rehearse. And so I pretty much just had to get up there and play with him. So if you ever get to see that show, check it out with that in mind. It came out really well, and it came out so well that sponsors begin to see it and say, well, we'd like to hire that show to have it at our college or our function. And so Doc and I were on the road for the next 14 years with that.
Well, I think that's where you really distinguish yourself. I mean, you've won all kinds of awards for your musicianship, and there's just no doubt about how well you play. But it's this communication and being able to bring out the best in other musicians and to sort of get them – to tell you how it's done and why it's done. That kind of relationship you have with musicians seems to me pretty powerful. In fact, you won a couple of Grammys for your collaboration with Doc. Tell us about Legacy, because that's a recording, I think, that becomes essentially Doc's biography, right?
Exactly, yeah. Oh, thanks for noticing that. Yeah, Doc never wanted anyone to write his biography. He never would allow that, authorize one. And I said, well, Doc, why don't you just tell it? You tell what you want to tell. And if there's something in there you don't want in it, we'll take it out. And so he told it like it was. There was very little that he wanted to take out. And so there was the music and the stories of his life, and that actually became his biography. And the great thing about it is Doc had this wonderful way of speaking that was country and yet very you could tell he was a deep person. You know, it was deep, it was educated, it was intelligent, it was soulful. And so just listening to Doc talk is like a good part of the value of that record, I think, because he just almost spoke in poetry.
Well, why don't we do that right now? Here's Doc talking with you about his very first banjo. Let's listen.
David, when I got this banjo, it didn't have these nice fancy tuners on it.
Mm-hmm. You've had that since you were 14?
Yeah. Carried it around New York in the dues-paying days when I was playing coffee houses. And that same little old case there.
It's a little cardboard case. You've treated that thing very well. It's an old Kalamazoo banjo. It's a beauty.
Yeah.
Now, where'd you get that one at 14?
My dad and my cousin Virgil Carroll were working on the WPA at the time, and they got to talking about the little homemade banjo, and Dad said, I want to get him a better one sometime, as soon as I can. And Virgil said, I got one I'll sell you. I can't pick for nothing. And he said, I don't know why I ever bought it. I'll sell it to you for $7. Said, that's what I got in it, and that young'un needs it. And Dad said, well, I'll pay you for it as long as I can. He said, just a dollar or two now and then. And, don't pay it all down.
80 cents a day, it took a while.
Boy, I'm glad I got a hold of it. I wish somehow Dad could know I've still got it and how good it sounds. Old Georgia Buck is dead. The very last words he said, don't never let your woman have her way, boys. Never let your woman have her way.
That's Doc Watson playing and singing and talking with David Holt, my guest today on The State of Things. That's from the Legacy album that traces Doc Watson's life and music. So often you hear musicians and other artists say, look, my story's in the music. If you want to know what I'm all about, just listen to the music. But I wonder about that, and I wonder how important it is or what it does for us as listeners, for you as a musician, David, to know the stories behind the music. Does it help? Does it make much of a difference?
Oh, it's super important to me personally. I mean, I'm a historian of the music just for my own interest. But I find that telling somebody where a song comes from, something interesting about the song or the person I learned it from, really gives them a context. We have no context for this anymore. The people, we have to create our own context. The people that made this music when I was younger, they're all gone, and they were a very special, wise group of people. I think Alice Girard first said it, they were created before self-doubt was invented. These people were solid, centered, and, incredible people. People like Etta Baker and Doc and Wade Maynor and Tommy Jarrell and Fred Cockrum, Delly Norton, all these great, great folks. The stories are important.
Stories are important. The music is great. You brought a few things with you. I think you got an American guitar there.
Yeah.
Why don't you pick that up? And that to me has always been a kind of a fascinating instrument anyway, in its place in traditional music, in country music, popular music. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that guitar and, play something cool.
Sure. This is a National Resophonic guitar, a steel guitar, people call it. This is the original steel guitar because it's made of steel and was made to play Hawaiian music on, but, folks in the Southern Mountains didn't care much about Hawaiian music, but they loved it for blues. And so they, many African-American folks would take a broken bottleneck and put on their finger, or like I have a piece of pipe, metal pipe, brass pipe, on it, on my finger, and they would play stuff like this.
David Holt on the steel guitar and live on the State of Things. You got a special coming up on UNC-TV. That sound, and you played that banjo earlier today and talked about how these sounds are you know, in a way, they just get right to the soul. I know that particular instrument and that kind of music helped you. You talked about when your daughter passed away in a car accident, and that was pretty helpful to you, was it not?
Oh, it saved my life. Really, it literally saved my life. I was so depressed, and so I really just didn't know if I could stay alive anymore. And my mother's plumber gave me a national guitar. He just had it and didn't have anything to do with it. And so I live up here in the mountains of Asheville, and it was these beautiful November sunsets, and I would just get that thing, and I didn't know how to play it, but I just do stuff like it just helped me. It sort of got down in the pain with me and helped me lift it out. And finally, I did that long enough that I was finally able to play the instrument. That was not my goal at the beginning. It was just to kind of survive. Yeah. So I really love this thing.
Don't you think that's how music started, David? Trying to figure out how to ease the pain and just banging on something. And then as it begins to resonate, you think, well, maybe I can do it better tomorrow if I just work at it.
And I think we just had this natural thing about rhythm. We just, you know, just love rhythm.
But there's something about those instruments, the guitar, the way you just played it, where you bend those notes, where you hammer on it and they pound off and the note kind of slides into, you know, that is the essence of grace, right? We started someplace and then magically ended up in another pitch, and you didn't hear how you got there. I mean, I just wonder if there isn't some sort of mystical quality, particularly these instruments, stringed instruments.
They go deep, that's for sure.
Well, you do a great job. You've got this program. I got to see a little bit of a preview. David Holt, State of Music. By the way, great name. What an inspiration for a name for a show, State of Music. Where'd that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Denny McIntyre thought it up.
We brother and sister in public broadcasting. That is.
The idea of state was very good.
That's very cool. But tell us about it, because you've got some great people. Brian Sutton is on here, Josh Goforth, Rhiannon Giddens, Balsam Range, to name a few. Tell us a little bit about the show.
So what we wanted to do was have a show that where we interviewed the guests, we took them into beautiful locations, we allowed them to play a whole song, so the song would really breathe. There would be, you know, you didn't have the announcer coming in and talking right away. The person could actually do a full song, or maybe two. And so our thought was, let's just get the people that are just the very best in their field, and also folks that are just about to break loose on a bigger national level. And pretty much most of these folks are. Brian Sutton is one of the great guitar players alive today, one of the greatest there's ever been, I guess. He's just so fluid. And then he tells about in the show how he is able to play that fast and that accurately. And then he plays some stuff, of course. And Balsam Range, a great bluegrass band from this part of the state that's just tearing things up all over the country. And they're getting quite a lot of notoriety. And then Rhianna Giddens, you know, from the Chocolate Drops. What a fabulous, beautiful, intelligent woman she is, and a great musician. She was talking about in the show the evolution of the banjo and the black influence on the banjo. And that's been very something that's very important to me, is for people to realize how important the black influence is on this music. It's what made this music, basically, this combination of the black influence, the African-American influence, with the English, Scotch, and Irish influence. So, you know, instead of, for example, harmonica was played like this by white folks, and finally black people came along and figured out, you know, that kind of a sound. And that just changed the music, that rhythm and that those soulful blue notes changed it remarkably. And then Bruce Mulski, probably one of the greatest of the old-time fiddlers, who's kind of started about when I did, learning from Tommy Jarrell and Fred Cockrum, and he's taken the fiddle to taking those old techniques and made them just a little more modern and just a little more driving. And in that little piece you played before this, I'm playing Hambone along with him, and he's fiddling and singing, and it's just a, you know, it's just a powerful combination. And then we have a African-American gospel group, black gospel group, called the Branchettes, and they're just piano player, singer, Lena Mae Perry, just incredible.
Real genealogy there, too. The Branchettes go back generations, right?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Oh, and then Josh Goforth, who's my good buddy and one of the young phenomenal musicians from North Carolina, who's, you know, just gets, you're going to be hearing about Josh for the rest of your life because he's just such a great musician. And
ballad singer, right?
Well, he sings ballads in this show, but Josh can do anything. He can play fiddle great. And what's wonderful about Josh is, you know, we have a duo. We actually play a lot together. But he's related to all those old people in Madison County that I learned from when I was in my 20s. People that he knew about because they're his relatives. But, of course, he never met them because he's only 33 or something now. But to me, it just feels like a complete circle working with Josh. It's like the blood of those people is still flowing in the music, which is great.
So, David, this is just a one-time special, huh? Can this become a series?
UNC-TV has asked us to make a series out of it, but, you know, we have to raise the money for that. This is the way it works. You raise the money, you make the show, you give it to public television. So it's a kind of a funky business plan, but it's just the way it works. And so we're in the process. Well, actually, Will McIntyre is in the process of raising the money to make a series. We'd love to do it because there's so many more people in the state. I mean, you know, there's just our state is so full of great musicians.
Well, then you could branch out, go up and down the mountains, and get into stuff almost eternally. So we
would love that. Yeah. So we're looking for somebody who would underwrite that.
Well, we're grateful at least for this hour, David. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
David Holt, musician, storyteller, a communicator and host of David Holt's State of Music, a one-hour special hosted by David. He's going to introduce viewers to modern masters of traditional music in the Southern Mountains. David Holt's State of Music airs Thursday, January 29th, 10 o'clock, UNC-TV. If you go to our website, we have a timeline all sketched out. You can take a look at a lot of what we talked about in David's life as he learned the music and moved here to Western North Carolina, and also details about the state of music. All of that at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mwagdi, and Will Michaels. Jess Clark is our intern, Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.
Let it rain, let it pour, let it rain a whole lot more, 'cause I got them deep river blues. Let that rain drive right on, let the big waves sweep along, 'cause I got them deep river blues.